Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your guest host, Dr. Ann Zink, the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. In the U.S., we spend more on healthcare than any other industrialization, and a huge amount of that spending comes from just a small percentage of our population. In Alaska, 52% of Medicaid spending comes from just 5% of the recipients. Many of these Alaskans have complex, intersecting health needs, including medical conditions, behavioral health challenges, disabilities, and other factors. As an emergency department physician, I hear these patients describe feeling as they're falling between the cracks of a fragmented healthcare system. And we can do better. Today, we're diving into the world of complex care. We'll explore the struggles that many Alaskans face when their healthcare needs don't neatly fit into the boxes of our system. And we'll discuss ways we can improve coordinated care for those with complex needs. We'll also talk about what you can do if you're a patient, a family member, a healthcare provider, or a member of the public who cares about improving health systems and improving complex care. Joining me today are three leaders in the space: Dr. Tom Quimby, the medical director at Mat-Su Emergency Department in Mat-Su Regional Hospital; Jeanette Lacey, the director of case management at Bartlett Regional Hospital; and Dr. Bree Oswald, the deputy director of complex case systems within the state of Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. Welcome to the show. I'd like to remind our listeners that today's program is pre-recorded and will not be taking calls. In the first part of the show, we'll get to know our guests better. We'll talk about complex care means to them, and we'll dive into the work that they're doing to improve care for patients. And then we'll move into what's next for our guests and what listeners should take away from our discussion. So let's dive into the show and learn more about our guests. So first, Dr. Tom Quimby, you're an emergency department physician. What drove you to get involved in the work with complex care systems? What does that really mean to you? And what, take us through what it looks like for a patient.
Well, thanks, Anne. First, I have to say it's a real privilege to be on the program today. I've been a longtime listener, and actually, I think maybe the founder of the program, or at least a longtime host, was Dr. Thad Woodard, and he's my pediatrician, so it's kind of fun to feel like we're coming full circle here. But yeah, I guess in answer to that series of questions, I think most people would understand that as an emergency physician or an emergency department, our stated mission is primarily and first and foremost to be the best possible person and place if you're having a medical emergency. So if you're having a stroke, you're having a heart attack, a trauma, we work really, really hard. Most people go into the field because they want to be the person there for that. And I think the public understands that. But what I think maybe is less understood is that we're also a place that's open 24/7. We see everyone regardless of their ability to pay or their insurance status. And as a result of that, we end up being a fail-safe for the system. And so as a result, we often see the results of system failure. And what that means is it's individuals who fall through the cracks for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into. And so for me, I don't know if you've ever, I think everyone's probably had the experience where you deal with a problem that you see over and over and over again, and you start feeling powerless to change it. And that is what really burns people out of careers, specifically our field. And so the opportunity to go, in a sense, upstream and deal with some of those problems has been really impactful for me and by default for my colleagues so that they start seeing some solutions to these problems. And complex care is not really a word that I personally was like super aware of or that I use frequently, but what I think it is, it does illustrate well what we see, and that's people who usually will have a medical problem that's compounded either by multiple medical problems or a variety of other issues, oftentimes mental health problems or social problems such as substance use disorder, homelessness, transportation issues. And those are the people that we see oftentimes falling through the cracks that come in over and over again. And, you know, it's up to us to try to figure out what to do with them and to help, how to help them best.
Yeah, super helpful. You as a clinician, it sounds like this has been kind of a solution to burnout for you. Can you just give an example of a patient or a way that you've been able to intervene or to engage in kind of complex care that's been meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, that is really true for me. I didn't realize, you know, one of the things that was really contributing to burnout in the job was this just feeling powerless to help some of these people who have real problems. And then you get to know them because we see them a lot. So one example would be, you know, over the years, we've had a number of young people who, unfortunately, for no fault of their own, end up getting type 1 diabetes. They have to take insulin every day, or they literally could die. They end up, you know, having all kinds of other health problems that start compounding. And all of us who've made it through our teenagers, that was a tough time already. You throw that on top of it. So unfortunately, a lot of them end up having other social problems. They, you know, may not have insurance and be able to afford the medications. They may end up falling into substance use disorder. And so we'd see a number of these people, and they come in on the brink of death in something called diabetic ketoacidosis. They're going to the ICU. We're doing procedures, putting central lines in them, sometimes intubating them. And I mean, when you see that over and over again in the same people, that hurts. That does not feel good to see a young person in your community who really is going to live a lot shorter life. A lot of people die in their 20s and feeling powerless to help them. So, just that is one example. We had one individual like that who was coming in all the time. We couldn't even get IVs on him anymore. And by getting them connected with some of this case management that we'll talk about, you know, this individual was able to stay out of the hospital. They were able to get their medications. They were able to get a job, and they were able to live a longer, healthier life, hopefully. And that was just a really good feeling to finally feel like we could help someone in that situation.
Yeah, it makes such a difference. It's that moral injury of seeing that same problem over and over again and really moving to serve patients. You know, thinking about serving patients, I want to turn next to you, Jeanette. You know, you work at a different hospital in Bartlett Hospital, come from a slightly different perspective. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you into this work, into case coordination in the hospital, and why do you do this work?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much also for having me here today. You know, I have been at Bartlett for 21 years now, and back in about 2012, we started talking about having case management in the emergency room. That's when we first started talking about actually having case management specific for that department. And a lot of it comes from exactly what Dr. Quimby was talking about. That piece of it is very, very similar. And so we started out pretty slowly. And, you know, for me, it was just about getting to know these patients, getting to know the folks that are coming in repeatedly to try to understand what's happening with them outside the hospital. And, you know, what could I do as a case manager? At the time, I was a direct patient care case manager. And what could I do with that patient to help meet their needs in a way that they did not need to come to the emergency room on a weekly or, you know, every other day sometimes basis? How could we get those needs met? And so that's kind of where we started. And that's, you know, really just trying to look at what we can do to help people live a better life.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thinking about how the whole hospital system can move together. How do you guys define complex care? You know, when we were setting up this show, one of the team asked us to define complex care, and we kind of laughed because it's defined in such a different way. So tell me a little bit from your perspective on how you define complex care when you are speaking about patients who are kind of falling through the cracks of the system. What do you or your team think about? How would you define that?
Yeah, thank you. Again, I think a lot of it is a bit similar to what Dr. Quimby was speaking of. But, you know, a lot of times we have patients that have severe mental illness or substance use disorders or cognitive delays, severe trauma histories. And you know, when those things overlap, and then you throw in social drivers of health, housing, transportation, access to food, things get really difficult because you have a patient who might really be looking to just meet their basic needs, and they can't really address these other issues, and they can't get to a primary care provider because, you know, without housing, it's not very easy to make appointments and remember appointments and coordinate how to get to appointments. So it's really looking at what are these underlying issues that are impacting this patient? And when somebody has enough of these issues that they cannot independently access the services that they need, that I think is a complex patient for us.
Well, Jeanette, like, why would a hospital be involved in those challenges and issues? You know, housing isn't the role of a hospital. Food isn't the role of the hospital. Why do you all, as case managers at a hospital, get involved in this work?
Well, you know, like keep going back to Dr. Quimby, but like he said, we are open 24/7, and we take anybody who shows up, right? That's what we're here for. We want to help people, and primarily with their medical issues. But if they're showing up over and over and we can't treat them medically, it doesn't matter whether the emergency room was designed for emergent medical issues or not. Folks are going to show up. So we can either choose to, cycle through, or we can say, okay, what can we do to address this issue to meet their need? We're not going to move forward. We're going to have these continued visits. And we see a significant decrease in those, non-acute emergency room visits when we can get involved and figure out what's happening and address those needs. So it's best for the patient, and it's also best for the hospital, and it's also best for our staff, because it's really hard on staff when they keep seeing the same patients and they feel like they can't help that patient. This way they can see that we are able to help our patients, and it helps our staff feel better about the work that they're doing every day.
I appreciate you highlighting that. I think both with what Dr. Quimby's saying, what you're saying, that there's kind of really three major buckets: helping patients to do better, helping staff to feel like the work that they're doing is really impactful, and then helping the system be more efficient and be more cost effective. Is there anything else I'm missing in that you think are highlighted?
I mean, I think those are the big things, but the other piece of it that's sort of outside the hospital but really important is that the community partnerships are also then really strengthened because of the work that we do and how we do our work. We continually engage with the same partners, and those relationships only grow stronger and more efficient as well. So it expands outside the hospital.
Yeah, I love that you bring that up before, Jeanette.
Yeah, no, just into the greater community setting, I think it's probably from there just spreads out, right?
Yeah, there's, some interesting data that 80% of our health is determined by things outside of the healthcare system, and the ways that communities work together really show community resilience, I think really highlighting the role that all of us play in a community for that health. So I appreciate you really bringing up that community connection. I want to turn to you next, Bree. Dr. Oswald, tell us a little bit about your background. Like, how did you get into this space? Tell us a little bit about your journey. Help us understand why you're in the role that you are now.
Yeah, I ask myself that quite often. I'm kind of like a jack of all trades is what I consider myself. So my background, I'm an occupational therapist by trade, and I've had time in neurological rehabilitation, acute care, skilled nursing, and more recently, acute psychiatric care at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And that's where rubber really hit the road, where we saw, similar to the emergency department, where API is kind of like the safety net of the state. When individuals don't know where to go and they have serious and persistent mental illness, they come to us to get care and to be treated with dignity and respect and recover. However, when there's no step downs, then they get stuck in the system. And that's kind of where my role came in, is working with the complex individuals, mostly with behaviors is how we define complex care. Is, yeah, you might have serious and persistent mental illness and maybe some uncontrollable diabetes and maybe some other mental physical conditions, maybe like wound care, something like that. But also maybe you have aggressive behaviors that are hard to manage, or maybe you have some delusions that cause you to be a danger in society without supervision, or maybe you disrobe inappropriately, things like that, where it's not compatible with being in the community until those things are remediated or supports are set up with that. So we've been able to work really hard with those folks who've just been stuck in the system. And I think it's two parts with those folks: of it's not a setting where people should live long term. There's a lot of restrictions in API meant to keep people safe in a short term, but it's not meant to be a residential setting. And unfortunately for some people, it is, because they've been denied from every single in-state and out-of-state option. And they deserve a higher quality of life, and they deserve to be out in the community if they are able to. But the other problem is, from the ER side, is when a bed's taken up by somebody who's living there residential, we can't get people in to get treatment as well. So it's kind of a two-parter of how do we get these folks out and how do we keep, you know, the system chugging along so that we don't get these, you know, just log jams kind of going in there. And I love what Jeanette was saying about community partners, because we developed actually a transition program. We found that folks that stay at API for extended periods of time develop these institutionalized behaviors, and they don't know what it's like to be in community, and transitions are incredibly hard. And that's where we see failed discharges, 30-day readmissions, and our goal is to keep them in community and to make it successful. And so I remember some of our folks who had co-occurring intellectual developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, behavioral issues, autism, and plenty of other things going on. And, you know, just getting outside the building for 20 minutes was so challenging for them. But then we could do 20 minutes and then 40 minutes, and then we're going to the grocery store to practice shopping and, you know, getting back out there. And one of our most historically assaultive patients is now successfully out in the community for over 180 days and is managing his behaviors. And I think part of that is hope, and seeing that hope from, we are giving him the ability to try to get out of community, that there, it's not, I'm stuck here. And I'd go back to do what Dr. Quimpy was saying of, it made our staff feel more successful and positive. If you're getting in, you know, a hands-on physical restraint every 2 days with those folks, like, why do I want to come to work? I feel like I'm not helping him. And now we're able to see, you know, putting this work in over time and working with him, we were able to get him out in community. And I think some of our staff to this day, like, are like, how's he doing? Like, what's going on? And, you know, it's a proud moment for them of like, okay, like we made a change in this young man's life. So those are the things that get me going. And that's how I got in this work.
I love that. I love the hope that you hear in that. You know, we know that 1 out of 5 healthcare workers have left the field in the last 5 years. And we hear a lot about burnout, and we hear about the incredible shortages in the healthcare workforce. But what I'm hearing through all of you all is the ways that systems have been able to change to create hope for your patients, and how that creates hope in your staff. I know that you were at API, and then you moved over to the role in the state. And so tell us a little bit about what your role is now at the state, how that fits to what your role is with API, and how that transition's been.
Yeah, it's been an interesting transition, and I'm always a clinician at heart. So now I'm out of the commissioner's office for the Department of Family and Community Services, which has Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Office of Children's Services, so all the child welfare state-run agency, the Division of Juvenile Justice, and the Alaska Pioneers Home, which is our state-run assisted living home for elders. So now I get to expand my complex care knowledge and understanding across all of those entities, and also working with our sister agency, as I like to call it, the Department of Health, who really build out the continuum of care with the licensing and the funding piece to figure out where are the gaps, how can we support these needs. And also they've given me a little free reins to consult, and so I've gotten to go in to, you know, a juvenile justice wing and do some groups and provide some consultation for our complex, you know, girls treatment unit, and you know, go visit with the elders and have coffee, and they will tell you what they want, and they're lovely, and I love that. And obviously OCS has some really tricky and challenging cases too, so anything we could do to support them. It's been an interesting role, and I've been building it out, and we're in our foundational, you know, kind of level, and we're going to continue to grow out from there.
Yeah, I loved hearing that all the different divisions that you all support, as you mentioned, used to be one agency, and then the department split. And there's been a lot of great work that's been happening. But, you know, just like I asked Jeanette, like, what's the role of the hospital? Why is the state government's role at all? Why are you guys even involved in trying to figure out complex care systems? Help us understand why you do that, why it's important.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we serve the most vulnerable Alaskans. That's our mission. That's our vision for what we want to do. And the most complex are the most vulnerable. Also, they have the highest needs, and so they usually need the most support. And so that's what the state is here, and DFCS says, we don't seek them out; they come to us. But if we could be proactive rather than reactive, because being in a system, you know, the best thing for them is being in the community. If we can allow that, and we don't want them to get stuck. And so when they do get stuck, it's our opportunity to look at that and say, okay, how can we do better? Even if this takes 5 years, you know, there's somebody going to be like this 5 years down the road. So we got to start the work now to improve the system for everyone in the future.
Great. I've heard this kind of theme through all of you all about community. And I guess, you know, Dr. Quimby, I bring that back to you. You know, you talk about the emergency department being open 24/7, being able to care for everyone. How do you interact with the community in the emergency department and in this space? What do you see as the role for community in complex patients?
Yeah, I think a lot of the general public going to the emergency department would be an infrequent occurrence of last resort. And frankly, we're not offended at all that you don't want to come see us. That's totally fine. And I'm really happy that most people are healthy and they don't have to go to the emergency department very often. But I find that a lot of times the general public doesn't understand that there is this small subset of people who end up coming to the emergency department many, many times a year, sometimes even multiple times in the same day. And these are members of our community, and what that represents on some level is a system failure where they're not getting their needs met elsewhere. And so by choice or even not by choice, you know, we end up having to find solutions for these people. And we're confronted with this reality, you know, every day. So again, by choice or not by choice, we are a big part of the community, and we see oftentimes just the worst things that happen. And so that, you know, that really, that can motivate some people to go out into the community and find some solutions for those problems that we've talked about here.
Yeah, great. You know, and to speak about community and to speak about hope, in the next section, we're going to talk a little bit more about these three remarkable leaders and the work that they have done to create solutions to these problems. So just a reminder, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is a pre-recorded show. We'll not be receiving calls today, but after a short break, we'll continue discussion about complex care with Jeanette Lacey, Dr. Tom Quimby, and Dr. Bree Oswald on Your Line One Continues Statewide. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your guest host, Dr. Ann Zink. Walter Cronkite once said, America's healthcare system is neither healthy nor caring nor a system. But today we dive into a topic of complex care, how it is and how it affects Alaskans, and how do we fix that system and improve it. I'm joined today by three remarkable experts, Jeanette Lacey from Bartlett Hospital in Juneau, Dr. Tom Quimby from the Mat-Su Regional Hospital, and Dr. Bree Oswald from the Department, Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. I'd like to remind our listeners that this is a pre-recorded show and will not be taking calls today. But now that we've gotten to know our guests a little bit better, we're going to hear a little bit more about what they're doing to improve patient care with complex needs across our state. So let's circle back to Dr. Bree Oswald. You were talking a bit about what you're doing at the state. Can you tell us about what Alaska Psychiatric Institute, as well as what Alaska Department of Family and Community Service, are doing to address the needs of complex patients?
Yeah, absolutely. We have this internal program. It's fabulous. I set it up. Just kidding. But we identified internally who our complex individuals are. We use a screening tool to identify those with medical needs, complex behaviors, challenging presentations, and, you know, either some legal issues that are going on, which typically happens in our population, as well as just some ethical issues going on and those social supports needing transition. And then we have an interdisciplinary approach to identifying the barriers, addressing them proactively, and then providing education during the transition process, as well as slowly acclimating our individuals back to the community setting. And we found that tracking the data that we have gone from individuals having a history of around 15% failed discharge to zero failed discharges. And then almost 56% of the individuals had a history of 30-day readmissions to API, and we've dropped that down to under 4% with this process. And then I just continue to track the data, and we're hitting a higher number of people being out in the community 180 days, 6 months. So if you look at a quality of life perspective, that is less back and forth, less ER visits, better continuity of care because they're able to get their needs met in a primary care level and getting wrapped into services rather than bouncing back to the ER, having to go through, you know, if somebody has sensory issues, for example, the ER is loud, there's people in and out, you don't know the provider, there's things going on that might be very challenging, especially with somebody with serious and persistent mental illness. And so our goal is to keep them out and keep them back in those lower level of cares. And then just from a cost perspective, I know API is is, you know, just being there at the daily rate is very expensive. Being in a lower level of community is less expensive, but also you just build those relationships and rapport. And one of the challenges that we have is burning out providers and patients getting blacklisted. Like if you go to a place and tear it up or do something bad, that provider won't serve you anymore. And then they're less likely to serve other individuals coming out of our institution. So this has also been going back to community, building those relationships and saying, hey, we're supporting you. We know there might be some road bumps around here. How can we walk with you? How can we show you how we de-escalate the patient? How can we show you how they take their medications? How can we show you what they need before they get in a car so that they're safe during a drive? And all those little bitty details make a huge difference for the individual. And I think a lot of our community providers, I think, still have my cell phone number because they'll like text me and give me updates about patients I've discharged that are doing well. And just having that relationship is huge, especially in some, a state like Alaska where everyone knows everybody. And as big as we are, we're all interconnected here. So just one of the things that we're working on to meet the needs of our complex folks coming out of API.
That is honestly some remarkable data. You know, we don't always see what we don't know. And to think about how stable those patients are, the fact that they're circling back through the emergency department, back into API, I mean, you're really making that investment from API count, that once someone's able to be stabilized, that they're able to get the care that they're needing, then they're able to make them succeed in the community. And it's a huge, huge return on investment, both from a mental perspective as well as a financial perspective. So really fascinating, cool to hear. Tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with complex care needs and the system that's been set up within the state of Alaska as a whole now that you're in this different role.
Yeah, I had to take off my like clinician hat just a little bit and look more at policy and look at our statutes and regulations and see, you know, what license types do we have? What is our continuum of care? What resources do we have in the state? What resources do we have out in the state? And where are the gaps? And a lot of that came actually from joining Department of Health and the Behavioral Health Roadmap for Youth, particularly of going to the different regions and even understanding the different regional differences and the transportation costs. I remember going out to Bethel and learning about, you know, getting stuck and the transportation and this region the size of Oregon, you know, popping in and out, and how do you provide care in that setting. So it's just given me a bigger systems perspective and also making sure that culture is a part of it. I think that is huge, and each region has such a rich and diverse culture, bringing in, I'm going to say it again, community, and what does the community want, and what does that look like, and then seeing the gaps. Also just looking at data, I think, is huge, and connecting our data streams is also a really important thing to figure out where our gaps are, because if we're not talking to each other and we're not using the right data, we can't make the best decisions. So
yeah, it's been really exciting to see. And for listeners, on Line One, Your Health Connection website, you can be able to see that we have in the Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services a white paper up kind of explaining the work that's been happening now. So listeners are welcome to turn there. I want to turn next to you, to Jeanette. You know, I've been this like silent and now more vocal cheerleader of the MVP program down there. And I have to say, one of my career highlights was being able to hand you all an award at the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association meeting for the great work you're doing. But tell me a little bit more about the MVP program, how it got started, what it really does, and expand on the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to thank you again. It was such an honor for our team to receive that award. And it really meant a lot to everyone here. So I mentioned earlier that I started looking at our high utilizers, patients that were frequently in the emergency room as far back as 2012. We didn't really have a structure, and it takes a lot of collaboration and buy-in to pull a team together to do the work that we're doing today. So back in 2018, we had an invitation actually from the Washington Hospital Association to join with them in a project they were doing with Dr. Amy Boutwell. And she is the founder and president of Collaborative Healthcare Strategies. And so she was doing some education with us about reducing multi-visit patients. And I said, can we look at this model for an emergency department? Absolutely. And so that really helped us start to pull together a more formal framework and pull together the leadership of the hospital. And so it helped us pull in other departments in the hospital, and it made it bigger than case management in the emergency room. And so from there, it grew out to pulling in our community partners. And so what we're doing is we're looking at who are our patients that are coming to the emergency room the most frequently, and then pulling that team together to review what the needs of the specific patient are and how we can collaborate together and address those needs. And also I'll be on the same page with, what's happening, so that the care of the individual is not siloed with miscommunications or misunderstandings across teams. It really pulls together folks to have a unified approach with the patient and helping them achieve their goals. So that's really kind of how we got that framework and how we grew it from a case management program to a, hospital and community-wide program.
Yeah, I love that breaking down your silos and involving your community partners and well beyond case management. Help us understand, an example or a story of what that really means on a day-to-day basis for the work that you do and the work that your team does.
Yeah, sure. So, as I've mentioned, we're really looking at patients that have multiple visits, but sometimes even when a patient has one or two visits, we can tell right away that this is a really complicated situation. And so, as an example, we have a patient like that. They returned to our community, and they did not have any resources in place. They were unsheltered, but unable to meet their personal care needs. And so it made it really difficult for them to be able to be in a shelter, any of our shelters in the community. And so right away, it was a situation where we knew that if we weren't able to pull together and get this person what they needed, there is a very high potential that they would, decompensate or have severe problems in the community if they were sleeping outside, not able to take care of themselves. So there was a high risk of, very vulnerable person. And then also at the same time was not appropriate for an inpatient hospital, an extended inpatient hospitalization. So we reached out with our partners in the community, St. Vincent de Paul, Search, our mobile integrated health team, their community paramedics, Tlingit and Haida. And we pulled together with these different partners to say, okay, what does this person need and how can we work together to address those needs? And so everybody took a little piece of what was needed. And that's what I really love about our teams. Having worked together so much in the past, nobody feels like, this isn't a shelter issue. This isn't a hospital issue. Everybody sees this as having some collective ownership in addressing these challenges that our patients are facing. And it's a really great thing because everybody was able to pull together, get them the different funding sources that they needed and resources that they needed, help them connect with a primary care provider and dental services, and find an appropriate assisted living facility that this person could transition to. And in the meantime, the shelter staff was able to cover the cost for a hotel, and we had food delivery, and we had different people able to support this person in that hotel situation. And so, it's just so many people working together to get this person, because they weren't actually a patient in the hospital, but the vulnerability and the risk was there. Everybody pulling together to get this person what they need, to get them where they needed to be, to get the care that they needed. And that is, it's really exciting. And I just feel really proud of the team when I see all of them pulling together and making that happen.
I love hearing about all the different people it pulls together. You know, Dr. Oswald talked about the fact that when patients are able to be stabilized in community, that that frees up a bed at API and that they're not cycling back into API. But help us understand, you know, Jeanette, a little bit from a community hospital perspective. If you guys weren't able to stabilize this patient, get her into a long-term care facility, what would that have looked like for the inpatient side for a hospital? What does that mean for patient transfers, boarding in the emergency department, for someone who's coming in from a different reason? Help us understand from a larger hospital perspective what this means.
There's a lot of pieces to that, too. Being unfunded, of course, it puts a big burden on the hospital. And then even if Medicaid is established, then, you know, there's a burden on Medicaid, or there's a whole bunch of different funding issues with that and uncompensated care. And there's also, it goes back to the staff and how it impacts staff to have patients that don't need acute medical care, and that may really be more independent than somebody who's needs to be in acute care. If the hospital is full, you know, we can't transition patients from the ER. We can't transition patients from critical care up to med surge. So it can really impact the flow of care if you have, you know, too many patients in the hospital that don't need to be in the hospital. And we already have challenges with that on the other side of, you know, other challenging acute patients that are, we have difficulty transitioning. So it's just one more challenge with good hospital flow and being able to take care of the patients who really do need to be here.
No, that's great. You know, I know that early data from the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association estimates that at any given time, between 10 and 20% of patients in the hospital don't really meet criteria anymore and are complex and are there for different reasons. And I know they're doing a lot of work to move patients to be able to get them into different places. So let's follow that thread a little bit. You know, Dr. Quimby, you wear many hats, including, you know, the director of the Mat-Su Emergency Department, as well as the director of HUMS. Help us understand a little bit more, like, what this looks like from a clinician standpoint when the system gets really bogged down. And then talk us a little bit more through HUMS. I know that, you know, we were looking at your most recent report, and the third year report of the program showed that the HUMS program had saved over $4.7 million by reducing emergency department visits. And then when you rolled that over, it showed a 51% decrease in emergency department utilization. So tell us a bit more, both from a clinician standpoint as well as the HUMS, what you've learned and what you see and about that program.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. I think it's worth probably very briefly going back to my origins in this. I made friends kind of with the wrong people. I had this friend and coworker named Ann Zink who decided to go on a sabbatical for a year and asked me to take over some of her responsibilities temporarily, which ended up being long-term. But one of those responsibilities on the way out the door was, she told me, by the way, we just set up this grant-funded program called the Mat-Su High Utilizer Program, or HUMS for short. It's a grant-funded program by the Mat-Su Health Foundation. And the goal of this program is to help reduce high utilizers, or people who frequently come to the emergency department. And I'll admit, when I first found out about this, I was very skeptical. As an emergency physician, I think most of us who work in the emergency department just internalize this accepted fact that people who are going to come in very frequently and often, it's just part of the job. There's not much you can do to change it. And so the idea that some program would help with this, to be honest, is very skeptical. I will happily give the spoiler alert that I was wrong, and the program has been very successful, as I'll lay out. But basically what it is at a state, a grant-funded program in which we employ a number of caseworkers who do not need to be, you know, master's or higher level clinicians. A lot of times all you need is a high school education. We have a program coordinator. And then enrollment in the program is defined by this criteria that someone would need to have five or more visits to the emergency department within a year, which, as I said earlier, I think, you know, a lot of the general public just doesn't understand that that's happening or why it's happening, but it does. And We know from the data, which you know better than me, that those people who do come very frequently to the emergency department consume a very significant amount of healthcare dollars, particularly the Medicaid program. So it's really expensive. So on one hand, you know, one of the goals of the program is obviously to save money, and that is really important. I mean, we spend a tremendous amount of money in this country on healthcare. I mean, we have the highest percentage of our GDP that we spend on it. We spend more than the next five countries combined. So that's a really laudable and important goal of this program. And as you stated, we've been successful. We've saved a significant amount of money to the system. But then for me personally as a clinician, what that really means too is these repeated visits, as I think I stated earlier, is it's representative of system failure, and it's representative of individuals who are suffering and they're not getting the care that they need. Going back to that Walter Cronkite quote, I think also it's not really well publicly understood how fragmented our system is. Just an example, which we're working on changing, but currently if someone comes into my hospital and they say, I was discharged from your hospital yesterday, I went to your hospital affiliated urgent care today, I can't see those medical records at my computer without opening other programs or going to another computer. And that's within one system. And so, you know, if you just think about all of the other programs that are out there, primary care doctors, mental health facilities, substance use programs, housing programs, other hospitals, there's just very little or no communication or coordination. So that's why we see system failure sometimes. And the magic of our program really is that is as best as we can with a hospital-based program, we'll try to set people up for success, but when they leave the door, there's just a lot of times not as much that you can do. So we've empowered these community workers, these caseworkers, that they have access to resources. If someone needs housing right then, they can pick them up or arrange transportation. They can get transportation to the doctor. They can help them get their medications filled. They can help them apply for identification, Social Security, all of these other type of things that are really difficult for a hospital-based or other individual to do. So that really has been the success that we've seen, is just filling that gap that really other programs could not do. And as Jeanette stated, increasing communication.
Yeah, I love it. Well, you stepped in and done a much better job, and I've been grateful for your role in that space. But I know we're going to have to take another quick break for the station. Just a quick reminder, this episode is pre-recorded and will not be taking calls, and we'll continue our discussion on complex care when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your guest host, Dr. Ann Zink, and today we're doing a deep dive on the topic of complex care. Have you ever felt lost in the complexity of our healthcare system, unsure of where to turn and how to navigate the various challenges? Our fragmented healthcare system places a significant administrative burden on providers, but equally important on patients. With one of four people reported delaying or foregoing care due to administrative tasks, it's time that we figure out how to make systems work better for patients. And patients with complex health issues, those burdens don't just add up, they multiply. Our guests today are Jeanette Lacey from Bartlett Hospital in Juneau, Dr. Tom Quimby from Mat-Su Regional Hospital, and Dr. Bree Oswald from the Department of Family and Community Services. And we just heard about the important work they're doing with complex care. In this last part of the show, we're going to talk about what's ahead, the role that policymakers, providers, and our listeners can play at improving systems. And as a reminder to our listeners, this is a pre-recorded show, and so we're not taking calls today. So with that, I want to circle back to Dr. Tom Quimby. You talked a little bit about the work that's happening in Mat-Su, but what do you wish that patients knew, providers knew about the system? What do you think is important for policymakers to know about the HUMS program? And why does this matter for not only someone coming into the emergency department for, say, a dog bite or a car accident, but a patient with complex needs?
Yeah, so I think those are great questions. I would say first, for what I think policymakers and just the public needs to understand too, is the real problem that we're facing is sustainability and replicatability. As I mentioned, our program is grant funded, and it saves the system a ton of money to do this. And so we need to look at new ways to pay for this kind of care, because it is a cost saving thing to pay for it. But unfortunately, most of medical services or case management is wrapped up in master's level or higher clinicians providing diagnoses and therapies. And the whole magic of our program is, again, providing these oftentimes very simple, personalized, tailored care plans, communication and collaboration with many other organizations and agencies throughout the system, and then providing real resources that can be used in the here and now, such as transportation, housing, food, whatever it may be. And there just really is not mechanisms in place currently to pay for that, which is unfortunate because this does save the system money. So I think the public needs to know that. And I think, you know, if your primary concern is, you know, being fiscally responsible, which is a laudable concern, then this should be very important. But then on the flip side too, again, this is just like real individuals we're talking about. So probably for, you know, just to illustrate that, you know, as an example, really for me, this is almost a career highlight. There was an individual I've known for a number of years who started coming to the emergency department for some medical problems, developed a substance use issue, started getting all the medical problems associated with that, getting abscesses and infections. And eventually we were able to get her in this program. She was able to go to substance use treatment, get the medical care she needed. And a couple months ago, out of the blue, I was actually invited to go to her graduation from long-term rehab. And that, for me as an emergency physician who rarely gets to see what happens downstream, to get invited to go to that environment, to watch her graduate in that setting, to get reunited with her child that she'd lost custody of, really brought home to me that this is about these individuals who, you know, 10 years ago, the resources would not have been there to help her. And statistically, this individual would probably be dead at this time. So really that's what it's all about for me, and that motivates me. So yeah, it's just a huge honor to be involved in this work. It's exciting to see it happening in the community. It helps clinicians like myself and my colleagues feel less burned out. And I hope that there's more awareness. I'm glad we're talking about it today, and I hope that there are more policies in the future to make this more sustainable and replicatable. So thank you.
Yeah, I love that. I love hearing about them being connected. And like you mentioned, so rare to see that as an emergency department. So thank you for sharing that story and the work that you're doing in that space. You know, Dr. Briaz, well, I'll turn to you next. You know, same question to you. You know, what do you wish other people knew about this system? What's next, both within the state as well as with API? Help us understand why this is important and where the gaps are.
Yeah, I love what Dr. Quimby said about communication and collaboration, because one wise word that I got from actually Deputy Commissioner Ricci from the Department of Health is not one person has authority over everyone, but we all have influence over each other. And so that is just a really powerful message of how we can collaborate together to make change. One of the things that we hope to do in the DFCS side is some consultation and collaboration to provide technical assistance for the system, but also the goal through the year is to have a complex care advisory group. That's something we really want to establish and get more input. We do a lot of work between Department of Health and Department of Community Services, and we want, as we build out, to open up to our community partners, because we're in this together. You know, we're all work together in our systems, whether we're a small community provider, our hospital network, or a state entity, we all touch each other and we all touch the patient. And, you know, that communication and collaboration on cases. And I want to call out, you know, Dr. Quimby, you know, met me in Sitka one time, and we were able to collaborate about how to form an ethics committee and talk about, a very complex patient that is touching multiple systems and comes to our side in DFCS from an API ex parte, which is just a technical term of how they get referred to us. But, you know, we wanted the best for this patient, and we wanted to know what was the evidence-based practice, what are you going to respond, how are we going to respond, and how can we have a unified approach to working with this individual? And it just, you know, goes to show that we're just, you know, so many connections away from touching base. So communication, collaboration, and reach out and ask questions, and we're all working towards a solution here.
Yeah, great. It's been really fun to see the amazing work that you and your team have been doing in the complex care. So thank you for sharing that. Jeanette, I'm going to turn to you next. What are the gaps that you see in that Bartlett's MVP program? What do you wish that patients, providers, the public, policymakers knew about your program and how people can help more?
Sure, thank you. I just want to say I agree with both of the things that Dr. Oswald and Dr. Quimby have mentioned. But thinking about gaps, I want to expand on what Dr. Quimby was talking about as the funding and the sustainability of it. Another piece of the funding is that the way care is paid for is it's an episode, payment per episode of care. Patients register or they enroll or they do admissions processes. But a lot, as he mentioned, a lot of the work that is being done is not per episode or for a specific, clinical treatment, but more of a broad engagement of services. And also sometimes the patient isn't fully engaged in the initial work is engaging the patient in looking at what, how we could best meet their needs. And so thinking about creative ways to cover the costs of this type of care that is maybe different from how we do it for most of other things. And, things like housing and transportation and food. The patient I discussed earlier, those sorts of things were covered by our shelter teams. I mean, it's a very, it's there's it's a very disjointed, and it's who has some pot of money that they could put toward this one situation. But there's no real way to look at the care that we're providing and the services that we're providing and say, how could this type of care that's really saving a lot of money, improving staff satisfaction and is doing great things for the hospital as well. How can we support financially those types of services? So I think that's something that we really need to think about. And that's probably the main thing. And just, yeah, we want to keep doing this great work and we want to make sure that we can support as many patients as possible. So looking at it that way. As far as what patients can do, I think asking for help, I think when patients need help or being honest about what's, being open about what's happening with them, I know it's really hard sometimes, but we really want to help. And so if we know what's going on, that's, we really want to be able to support those needs.
Right. I really hear, Jeanette, your work at MVP program and Dr. Quimby's work at the HOMS is almost this connective tissue between that patient and the policy. And then hearing, Dr. Bree Oswald moving from the patient to the policy side and trying to be able to move the systems together to serve patients. But what I've also heard from you all is the role that community can really play in this, a shelter or EMS team or a housing unit to be able to provide services, to be able to connect to patients and what a big difference that makes. Not only for the care of those patients, but then also being able to make sure that the whole system works as a whole. We just have a few minutes left, but I would, this radio show goes out to people from everywhere, from Utqiagvik to Sitka to Anchorage. And some people may be very experienced in this space, and other people may, this would be the first time that they're hearing about this. What's the one thing that you wish that Alaskans knew or would take away and something that they could do for their daily life that would impact the role that complex care has, be it bringing in their medication or, as you mentioned, Jeanette, like telling, when you need help. So Jeanette, you started off by saying being able to say when you need help. Anything else that you would add in that space? And then I'll circle back around.
I think that's really the big thing. The other thing is having advanced directives and having somebody that you can name that you would want to help make your decisions for you if you're not able to. That's really important.
I love that. Advanced directives. Dr. Oswald, what would you say?
I would say speak up and be an advocate. I think when we have listening sessions or different opportunities, like come and speak, and we always joke, 5 minutes to complain, 55 minutes to solutions. So come with both. That's super helpful. But be an advocate and don't be afraid to, share your experience because that helps guide us.
And Dr. Quimby.
Agree with all the above. Very small thing as an emergency doctor. we'd love a current medication list.
Amen. So many thanks to our guests for being with us today and the incredible work they're doing across the state. Dr. Tom Quimby, the medical director of the emergency department at Mattsu Regional Hospital, Jeanette Lacey, the director of case management at Bartlett Regional Hospital, and Dr. Bree Oswald, the deputy director of complex system care within the state of Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. Today, we heard about healthcare system transformation, data systems, but most importantly, we heard about stories of Alaskans struggling with complex needs being met at where they are and truly cared for by some remarkable clinicians, their teams, and the community. The work is not about how we reduce emergency department visits, but ensuring that Alaskans who are struggling to have someone hold their hand who cares for them and is putting the patient in the center of their care. Thanks to all those who attend. If you can find more information, you can find more information about this and previous programs on our website, alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts and suggestions by emailing us at alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, your health connection. And I'm your guest host, Dr. Ann Zink. Thanks for attending.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.